Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we're discussing now the Mahasihanada Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. And we're in this section of the sutta dealing with the 10 powers of the Tathagata. This is on page 165. Starting on page 165. And last week I explained in some detail the first of these powers of the Tathagata. These powers are always to be understood as powers of knowledge, special kinds of knowledge that the Buddha has, which are quite unique to a perfectly enlightened Buddha. And these powers of knowledge enable the Buddha to perform the special function of a Buddha, that is, to establish the Dhamma in the world. Speaking in the poetic terms, this is what enables the Buddha to set in motion the wheel of the Dharma and to take that role of roaring his lion's roar in the assemblies, so that the Buddha can function as a world teacher, a universal teacher, because he possesses these special types of knowledge. Okay, and the first of these is the understanding of what is possible and what is of what is possible and what is impossible as impossible. And for a detailed analysis of these, one can look in a section of Sutta number 115. I discussed this last Tuesday. From page 928 to 930. You can look at this at your leisure if you weren't here last week. Okay, now we'll continue going on to page 166, the second type of knowledge. Okay, this is stated that the Tathagata understands as it actually is the results of actions undertaken, past, future, and present, with possibilities and with causes. This is a little obscure the way it's stated in the text. But as I mentioned last week, there's one book of the Abhidharma Pitaka, the second book called the Vibhanga, has a section which gives a detailed explanation of the 10 powers of the Tathagata. And that gives a very useful explanation of what is meant by the second power of knowledge of the Buddha. The Vibhanga, the book of analysis, explains that the Buddha understands that, okay, there are various evil or bad karmas that a person might do. And sometimes these bad karmas will ripen. They'll bring their fruits, their results. Sometimes they don't bring their results. Sometimes they don't ripen. the Buddha understands that sometimes a bad karma does not ripen because of four factors. There are four possible factors that might prevent the ripening of bad karma. What are these four factors? I'll write the Pali words and I'll explain them. Okay, gati means destination in the sense of the realm of rebirth, the place where one is reborn. So somebody might have bad karmas, but they might be reborn in a good destination, a fortunate destination, like a good state in the human realm or a heavenly realm. And because of that good rebirth, fortunate rebirth, those bad karmas don't find the opportunity to ripen. And so those bad karmas are blocked or prevented from ripening. It might be the case that the bad karmas have a tendency to ripen, say, in one's next existence. That's their tendency. Their propulsive force is to ripen only in one's next existence. But if one does some powerful good karma that leads one to a good rebirth, then those bad karmas might be blocked out so that they don't get a chance to ripen in the next life. And then those karmas, because they're blocked out, they wither up and die. They just don't have the chance to ripen. Okay, another factor that might prevent the bad karma from ripening is called upadhi, which here means, it could mean a person's physical body, or it could mean their possessions or property. Okay, so it might be the case that a person has some bad karmas that are tending to bring their results. But if this person has, say, a very strong, healthy body, then those bad karmas won't get the opportunity. They might not get the opportunity to ripen and bring their results of, say, of illness and early death if the person's body is strong and healthy. Okay, a third factor, preventive factor, is called kala, which means time. And so there might be some bad karmas that a person has accumulated, which have a tendency to ripen, but the person might be born in a favorable time, a time of peace and prosperity, a time of righteous government. And so because of this favorable historical period, those bad karmas don't get the opportunity to ripen. They miss their opportunity, and then they're blocked out, and then they lose their effectiveness and never get to ripen. And then the fourth factor, preventive factor, is personal effort. You might not know that you have some accumulation of bad karmas, but if you conduct yourself in a way which is good and wholesome, then your behavior will prevent these bad karmas from finding the opportunity to ripen. For example, somebody might have a tendency to some bad karma which is tending to ripen in the form of a premature death through some kind of accident. But if the person is very careful when they're driving, always take care of themselves, then that karma is prevented from finding the opportunity. Whereas if the person is careless and goes driving after drinking, that will give the opportunity for that bad karma to find the opportunity to ripen. So the person's personal effort can determine whether the karma will ripen or be prevented from ripening. Okay, and then the converse is true in each of these cases. For the bad karma, it can ripen because of birth in a bad destination. If a being is reborn, say, in a lower realm or under bad conditions in the human realm, then those karmas will get the opportunity to ripen. So the place of rebirth provides opportunities for bad karmas to ripen. That's why one has to have, or should make, a determination to try to be reborn under good conditions, favorable conditions. Similarly, if one has an unfortunate body, that's one with chronically weak health, or one doesn't have suitable possessions, that will provide the opportunity for the bad karma to ripen. If somebody has a weak body, then the bad karma will manifest in the form of disease, illness. If one is born in a bad time, the time of unrighteous rulers, the time of war, conflict, that will give the opportunity for bad karma to ripen and bring bad results. And then if one doesn't make any effort to lead a righteous, wholesome life, or if one makes the wrong kind of effort, if one applies oneself to wrong types of conduct, follows after bad, associates with bad friends, behaves recklessly, that provides the opportunity for the bad karma to ripen. Then the same principles all apply in regard to good karma. Good karma might not ripen because of unfortunate rebirth, unfortunate place of rebirth, unfortunate possessions, body and possessions, unfortunate time, unfortunate effort, the wrong type of effort. And good karma can ripen because of a fortunate place of rebirth, because of fortunate possessions and body, because of a fortunate time when is living in a fortunate period, and because of fortunate effort when makes the right kind of effort. So the working of karma that's undertaken and accumulated is very complex. There are many factors interwoven with it. And all of this comes within the range of a Buddha's knowledge. And this is maybe one reason why the Buddha says that one should not try to figure out the workings of karma. If one tries to figure it out, then one might go mad. He says that it's inconceivable, the complexities in the working of karma. Like sometimes there might be 100 high school kids who are singing songs. They like music and sing songs. Then some producer comes along and chooses 2 or 3 of them, picks them out, and suddenly they become the national hit, international stars. Till you have like this group, everybody is buying their records. They become the international sensation. Everybody has shirts with their name, fan clubs. Why does that happen? They're just ordinary kids who happen to like to sing songs, and somebody comes along and just picks them out of nowhere. Maybe it seems like fortune, but then you find out that 3 or 4 years later they have drinking problem, drug problem. 5 years later, two of them have attempted suicide. So it's not all good fortune either. Any questions about this? Only short questions, otherwise I could go on for hours.
There's probably no easy answer to this question, but as I'm thinking about what you're saying, I'm wondering if, on the Buddhist view, how many events in one's life or what percentage might be attributable to karmic impact? Is the idea that everything that happens to you involved in karma in some way, or just some of it?
No, certainly not everything that happens is a result of karma. There's a sutta where a wanderer comes to the Buddha and says, is it true that everything that happens to one is a result of karma? And the Buddha says, no. And he mentions many other things that it causes. He asks whether all the pains that a person experiences are the result of karma. And the Buddha says no, and he mentions other causes of pains besides karma.
Figuring out what's karma and what isn't might be very...
very difficult, yeah. Okay, we'll go on to the next one, the third type of knowledge. Here the Tathagata understands, as it actually is, the ways leading to all destinations. Okay, what are the destinations here? These are... no, it's not the way to the plane going to London, Paris, Frankfurt, Tokyo. Not the flight schedule. But the destinations are, first, it's the 5 main realms of rebirth. The hells, the animal realm, the realm of the afflicted spirits, also called the hungry ghosts, the human realm, and the various heavenly realms. And then the way that leads beyond all the realms of rebirth, the way to Nibbana. And so the Buddha understands what specific course of conduct, what way of behavior leads to all of these destinations. We will see this elaborated a little bit later in the sutta. Okay, then knowledge number four. The Tathagata understands as it actually is the world with its many and different elements. Okay, this means that the Buddha has understood the world in terms of all the different constituents that he's expounds in the suttas. So the Buddha has expounded the world in terms of, for example, the five aggregates. He's analyzed the world in terms of material form, feeling, perceptions, the volitional formations, and consciousness. And then he's taken each of these five aggregates and dissected each of these five aggregates into its components. He's explained the world in terms of the 12 sense bases, the eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and taste, the body and tactile sensations, and the mind and the mental phenomena. And then he's understood the world in terms of the 18 elements, that is, each of the 6 sense objects, the 6 sense faculties, and the 6 types of consciousness that correspond to each of the 6 sense faculties. And so the Buddha has, he doesn't just simply accept the world as a whole, but using his power of knowledge, he's dissected the world into all of these constituent elements and seen how all of these elements are just impermanent processes, conditioned processes, things that arise, subsist momentarily, and then pass away. Okay, and then we come to knowledge number 5. Here the Tathagata understands, as it actually is, how beings have different inclinations. Here the word inclination, the Pali word, is adimutti. Nana means different or diverse, and adimutti means inclination or disposition. And so the Buddha can use his special faculty of knowledge to look out over the world, and then he can see how people have different interests, different inclinations. Some have superior inclinations, some have inferior inclinations. And so the Buddha can understand this diversity in the inclinations of sentient beings. And knowledge number 6 seems a little similar to that, but is listed as a separate knowledge. The Tathagata understands, as it actually is, the disposition of the faculties of other beings, of other persons. Here, according to the Buddhist text, we have 5 spiritual faculties. The 5 spiritual faculties are faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And for the Buddha to be able to train the person, to guide a person, he has to be able to determine whether these faculties, first, whether they're strong, weak, or moderate. Then he has to know of a particular person which faculty is predominant in that person. Some people incline to faith. These are the devotional people who are of devotional temperament. People who are very pious, religious, emotional. Other people are more intellectual, investigative. Those are people who have panya as the dominant faculty. Other people are more energetic, vigorous, enterprising. Those are the ones who have virya, energy, as the dominant faculty. And then there are people who are naturally calm and collected, composed. Those are the people who have samadhi, concentration, as the dominant faculty. So ideally, in practicing the Buddha's path, one has to bring these faculties into balance. But people start off with one faculty or another will be stronger in different people. And so the Buddha, when he's teaching people, he's able to look deep into their minds and to know what faculty is strong in that person, what faculties are weak and have to be developed. He's able to know how to appeal to a person in order to make the Dhamma relevant to that person. He can read a person's mind and know their tendencies, their dispositions, going back many, many lives. This is how the Buddha can, when he meets, sometimes he'll meet a hostile Brahmin who is strongly opposed to the Buddha and argues with him angrily, and yet the Buddha can speak to this Brahmin and just with a few words can quiet him down and suddenly arouse some inspiration and confidence in that Brahmin, because he's able to read that Brahmin's mind and know the deep tendencies of that Brahmin, and then speak to him in a way which will awaken these hidden tendencies, these dormant seeds of, could be faith or of wisdom, lying buried in that Brahmin's mind. Or if he speaks to a farmer, he'll speak in a way that will draw the attention of that farmer. If he speaks to laborers, he'll speak in their terms. When he speaks to kings, he'll speak in their terms. And so he's always able to speak the Dhamma in the appropriate way because he understands these two knowledges, number 5 and 6, are what he uses, understanding the inclinations of beings and knowing their faculties, how to draw upon their faculties, and then how to, when he's teaching his disciples, how to guide them and to train them properly so that their faculties are developed in balance. And so they will reach the ultimate fruit of his teaching. Okay, then we come to knowledge number 7. Here the Tathagata understands, as it actually is, the defilement, the cleansing, and the emergence in regard to the jhanas, liberations, concentrations, and the meditative attainments. These are all different names for different types of state, types of attainments in meditation, especially in the meditation of samadhi. So we've met them in previous classes. The 4 jhanas we've met many times. The 8 liberations we met in the discussion of sutta number 77. The concentrations are just variations on the jhanas. And then there are 9 meditative attainments. The 4 jhanas, the 4 formless attainments, and then the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. And so what's called the defilement in regard to these attainments, all of these jhanas, liberations, and so on, that is the impediment or the hindrance that prevents one from entering into it. The cleansing is the method for removing that defilement, how to eliminate the hindrance, the impediment, the obstruction, in order to gain the meditative attainment. And then after one gains the meditative attainment, how to come out of it properly, that is called the emergence from the attainment. Okay, so all of this, the Tathagata, the Buddha, understands. That's one of his Tathagata's powers. Okay, Tathagata power number 8 is the recollection of past lives. We've discussed this many times in the past. Tathagata power number 9 is the divine eye, the ability to see the passing away and rebirth of beings. This I've discussed in the past. And then Tathagata power number 10, this is the knowledge of the destruction of the defilements, the destruction of the taints. So by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, the Tathagata here and now enters upon and dwells in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints, the destruction of all the defilements. So that is the ability to enter into the complete liberation of mind. Okay, so this completes the 10 Tathagata powers, the Tathagata powers of knowledge. Okay, then paragraph 21, now the Buddha is speaking with reference to this former monk Sunakata. If you remember the previous class, where we discussed the background to the sutta, there was this former monk Sunakata who had become angry with the Buddha. He disrobed because the Buddha wouldn't perform any miracle, any feat of psychic power. And so he was denouncing the Buddha and saying that the Buddha has no superhuman powers of knowledge. And so now the Buddha is saying, this is a rather strong statement, but the Buddha says to Sariputta, when I know and see thus, if anyone should say of me that the recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, he teaches his Dhamma merely based on reasoning, then unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in hell. It seems like a rather strong statement. Just as a monk possessed of virtue, concentration, and wisdom would here and now enjoy final knowledge, so it will happen in this case that unless he abandons that assertion and that state of mind and relinquishes that view, then as surely as if he had been carried off and put there, he will wind up in hell. Okay, maybe I'll ask if there are any questions. Yeah, please.
If spiritual facility, I have faith, energy, mindfulness, wisdom.
Say it again.
I have faith, energy, mindfulness, and wisdom. The five spiritual.
Okay, the one that's missing is concentration. Yeah. Okay, Eva.
In terms of the strong language, wind up in hell, could you explain a bit more why?
It's pretty strong, I know. I think because he's doing this, that monk is doing this with an angry mind. It's not simply that he's making the statement, but that the one who's making that statement was formerly a monk under the Buddha. If you read the first paragraphs of the sutta, he had been a monk, then he wanted the Buddha to perform psychic powers and miracles. And the Buddha had said to him that the purpose of my teaching is not to make displays. My purpose as a teacher is not to make displays of miracles and to show psychic wonders. But this monk repeatedly was asking the Buddha to show psychic powers, to show miracles, and the Buddha refused to do this. Then that monk became angry with the Buddha and gave up the monk's life. And then he went around in the city of Vaisali, which was a big city, denouncing the Buddha And saying that the Buddha doesn't have any kind of superhuman states, any special knowledge, any higher knowledge and vision. And so by doing this, he's trying to dissuade other people from placing confidence in the Buddha and trying to destroy their confidence, their trust in the Buddha. But I have to say, it still seems also strong to me.
An observation was going to be that it almost seems as though he would be preaching that heresy. If you want to equate it to heresy, is the ultimate bad karma then.
This monk.
Heresy to say that Gautama does not possess these powers, that he didn't gain this through wisdom, but only through reason.
Yeah, that is a...
And that's heresy.
It's a false statement, yeah, yeah.
And then it would seem as though he's saying that making that type of heretic statement is instant bad karma. Really.
It's a very foolish statement, yeah. Yeah, George.
I wonder about karma. The statements earlier, almost as if it's a chance, there's an element of chance. But there are other, I think it's in the Dhammapada, there's no place to escape karma, the depths of the ocean or cliffs and mountains, you cannot escape your karma.
Okay. Okay, that's a good point. Okay, the question is that how do we reconcile the tabulation made about the different factors that might obstruct the ripening of karma according to this list that I presented and the statement that comes in the Dhammapada that no matter where one might go, there's no way to escape the ripening of an evil deed. I think one has to understand that statement that comes in the Dhammapada as a kind of, let's say, a statement of moral advice, a heuristic device. It doesn't mean that there are no conditions under which an evil deed, under which bad karma will not ripen, but this is a kind of piece of wise counsel. Don't do bad deeds, because if you do bad deeds, you won't be able to escape the results of those deeds just by running away to other countries by trying to seek some physical refuge from them, because you always bring your bad karma with you. It remains stored up in your mind. So no matter where you go, your bad karma follows you along. It's part of your own mental makeup. And so it's always going to be seeking the opportunity to ripen. But it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to ripen. Whether it ripens or not depends upon other conditions. And in fact, it said that even though we do bad karma, we can create conditions that will, to some extent, prevent that bad karma from ripening by doing good deeds. Like if we've done something bad, if we do a lot of good deeds, wholesome karma, that will be creating, we might call this cushions, it could either prevent the ripening of that bad karma, or else it will weaken the impact of that bad karma. If that bad karma ripens, instead of ripening very powerfully, when it ripens, it will just ripen with a dull thud. Yeah.
Would that be the explanation for the Arahanthood of Anguimala, who committed all of those murders during his lifetime?
Okay, this is the case of Angulimala. Angulimala had killed many people when he was living as a serial killer. Trying to think whether this happened after or before he attained arhatship. Okay, but after he became a monk, one time he went on alms round And then people recognized him, and they said, there's Angulimala. And then the group of them, they got together, and they came after him with clubs, and they threw stones at him. And he came towards the Buddha. His robe was torn, his head was bleeding, and he was injured all over. And then the Buddha saw him coming towards him, and the Buddha said to him, bear it, Brahman, bear it, Brahman. You are suffering now the fruits of karma, which if you had not become a monk, how does it go? It's in Sutta number 86. He says, bear it, Brahman, you are experiencing here and now the result of karma, because of which you might have been tortured in hell for many years, many hundreds of years, many thousands of years. Yeah, this was after he became an arhat. So this was the way that karma had ripened, just in getting that beating.
Lesser than extent, because
yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like this. Even though some bad karma can be blocked by these four factors,
yeah.
But will they withered away, or they are lying dormant, and then they will ripen in some other future existences?
Okay, the question is, because of these four factors, will the karma be completely, will the karma completely wither away, or can it still ripen at some future time, in some future existence? Both cases obtain. There's some karma which has to ripen in a particular existence. That's karma which is tied to a particular existence. And so if that karma doesn't get the opportunity to ripen in that particular existence, then it is completely blocked. It never gets to ripen. There's other karma which is called paramparaya. Oh, my memory of these terms, not so good anymore. Okay, this is called, okay, translated, indefinite karma. This is karma that can ripen at any time in the future. This karma remains with one indefinitely throughout one's wandering in samsara. That karma, it might be blocked tentatively by one of these factors from ripening in a particular existence, but it will remain with one, and then it can get the opportunity to ripen at some future time in another existence. Okay, George.
Are these 10 powers unique to what Tathagata, or with an arahant?
In their totality and in their fullness, they're unique to a Buddha. Though I have to say that there's one passage that comes in Anuruddha Samyutta, in which, at the very end of the Anuruddha Samyutta, in which it's praising Anuruddha's practice of Satipatthana, and it's a series of little suttas ascribing different knowledges that came to the monk Anuruddha through the practice of Satipatthana. And then it mentions different kinds of the iddhis, different kinds of iddhis. Then it goes on to ascribe these 10, it doesn't call them Tathagata powers of knowledge, but it mentions these specific knowledges, and it ascribes them to the monk Anuruddha. But I think as the commentary says that he possesses them not to the same extent that a Buddha does. But I suspect that passage was added later by some reciter who was getting a little carried away. And just started adding different knowledges to ascribing them to Anuruddha. Because I don't see Anuruddha possessing these types of knowledges like the knowledge of the disposition of the faculties of other beings, the knowledge of the different inclinations of other beings. One never sees him, the text speaking of him as having those abilities. So if they are to be ascribed to anybody else, they would be in a very limited sense. But, of course, the last three, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye, and, of course, the knowledge of the destruction of the defilements, those were possessed by many arhants. Any further questions? Okay, if there's no further questions, maybe we could do the four grounds of intrepidity, or using a simpler word, call them the four grounds of self-confidence. In Pali, the word is vesarajya. These are four other qualities that are said to be special to a Buddha and that also enable him to claim that position of the leader of the herd. That's, again, it's a metaphorical expression. It's the position of the chief bull in a herd to roar his lion's roar in assemblies and set rolling the wheel of Brahma or the wheel of Dhamma. Okay, the first of these is that he sees no ground, no basis on which any ascetic, Brahmin, deity, Mara, or Brahma, or anyone in the world, anyone else in the world, could justifiably accuse him thus. While you claim to be fully enlightened, you are not fully enlightened in regard to certain things or certain dhammas. There are some dhammas which you have not fully awakened to. And seeing no ground for that, I abide in safety, fearlessness, and this word intrepidity is rather bookish, let's say self-confidence. So these are grounds on which the Buddha can teach his doctrine with perfect self-confidence. And this first ground is taken to be the claim for the perfection, you could say, of the Buddha's enlightenment, the perfection of his knowledge or realization. The question can be raised, what is meant by being fully enlightened in regard to all dhammas? The question comes up, does this mean omniscience? In the texts, the old suttas, the Buddha specifically rejects the idea of being omniscient in the sense of knowing everything, all facts, all the time. And I don't suppose that the Buddha would claim to know all matters of fact, of scientific fact. To me, that seems to be utterly ridiculous, that he could claim to know how to fix the bug in my computer. He would have known 2,500 years ago how to operate my computer today, how many blades of grass are on the lawn in front of Bodhi Monastery. How many? Tell me, how many? Never mind it's 2,500 years in the future. Tell me, I want to know. But what I would understand by being fully enlightened to all dhammas would be knowing all of the principles relevant to the spiritual life, knowing what are the things that are obstructions to enlightenment and liberation, what are the things that are favorable to enlightenment and liberation. Okay, the second ground of self-confidence. Nobody can justifiably accuse him thus. While you claim to have destroyed the taints, the defilements, the mental barriers, there are certain defilements, taints, that you have not yet destroyed. In other words, here the Buddha is able to claim perfect purity of mind, that he's destroyed all the defilements in all degrees without any residues or traces remaining. So his mind is perfectly purified of all of the asavas. These are the taints. This is the craving for sensuality, the craving for continued existence and ignorance. But along with those three, all other defilements will be included. Okay, the third ground for self-confidence. Nobody can justly accuse him thus, that there are certain things which you have called obstacles, obstructions, and yet these things are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. This ground of self-confidence arose in relation to the monk called Arhita. This was at the beginning of the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 22, the Alagadupama Sutta. The Buddha had claimed that indulgence in sensual pleasures is an obstruction to the path to liberation. But there was a monk called Arhita who went around saying that even though the Buddha says indulgence in sensual pleasures is an obstruction on the path to liberation, but as I see it, these sensual pleasures are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. And so that claim by Arhita led to the Buddha calling him up and chastising him, and then that led to the development of the whole Alagadupama Sutta. And then the fourth ground for self-confidence is the one that is relevant in this sutta. When you teach the Dhamma to someone, it does not lead him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. So nobody can make that accusation against the Buddha, because the Dhamma that the Buddha teaches will lead one who practices it to the complete destruction of suffering. Okay, so those are the four grounds of self-confidence, and possessing these four grounds of self-confidence, the Buddha is able to roar his lion's roar in the assemblies and set rolling the wheel of Dhamma. Okay, any questions? Yes.
The phrase "lion's roar" must be a reference to the content of the Dhamma, not the way it's expressed. Is that right? In other words, the lion-like power has to do with the content of the message, not the way it's expounded. Is that,
how would it relate to the way it's expounded? Certainly the Buddha wouldn't be speaking with roar, 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 not like that.
Right.
Yeah, it means, it's the power, I think it's the power of the exposition.
And of the teacher.
Yeah, because the Buddha is compared to the lion. The lion is the king of beasts. In the animal kingdom, the lion is the chief. And so, in fact, there's a sutta that says, in this world, including its gods and its human beings, the Buddha is the chief, the foremost. Yeah.
The reason I ask is because when I think of the Buddha, I don't think of a conventionally powerful, what's the right word? Imposing sort of figure, but maybe that's my own misconception.
I think physically he was probably quite powerful because he was from the Kshatriya clan, that was the warrior clan, and he was not really from lower India, but from the lower Himalayan foothills. I suspect it was like a mixture, partly like tribal people. So even according to the 32 characteristics of the great man, he was probably about 6 feet tall. He's described as having broad shoulders, broad chest, long arms, so probably physically quite imposing. Any further questions? Okay, then we will end with the sharing of the merit. And we'll continue. The next time will be June 5th and June 12th. We'll have the next two sessions. We'll finish the sutta on those two classes. Okay, we share the merits with the Devas, Buddhas, Nagas, and with all beings in this world, wishing all beings be well and happy and peaceful. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.